We really are doing a really poor job of helping people with a large number of musculoskeletal disorders. And compared to other countries, we use just orders of magnitude more diagnostic imaging, drugs, more surgery, more injections. I can't emphasize enough that there is so many more tools available now to help folks that are in persistent pain. The drugs, the surgeries, the injections, etc. They may have helped some, but as a nation, it's not the right direction. We clearly have to go a different way. And one of the ways I like to think about it is flipping the paradigm that we start when we have persistent pain with things that have high levels of evidence, such as mindfulness, breathing, physical activity, therapeutic neuroscience education, those types of things first. Those are your first line treatments. Don't start with the risky things first.
This is Like Mind, Like Body, a podcast about the surprising ways our thoughts and feelings can shape our physical health. I'm your host, Laura Sago. On each episode, I will speak with researchers, physicians, and ordinary people who have incredible stories to tell about the power of the mind-body connection. This podcast is brought to you by Curable, an app that gives you safe, effective tools to understand how to heal chronic pain. You can download Curable in the Apple App Store, on Google Play, or learn more at our website, curablehealth.com. On today's episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Tim Flynn. Dr. Flynn has quite the pedigree in the world of physical therapy. He's the past president and a current fellow of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists, associate editor for the Journal of Orthopedic Sports and Physical Therapy, a professor of physical therapy at South College in Tennessee, a practicing board-certified clinician at Colorado in Motion, co-host of the popular physical therapy podcast Pain Reframed, and also a member of our Curable Advisory Board. He'll be speaking with us today about the biopsychosocial approach to pain and how he believes that tools like simple breathing exercises and pain science lessons could pull us out of a nationwide opioid crisis. Let's get going. So, Tim, you host a podcast called Pain Reframed, where you are trying to shift how people think about pain and also how they approach treating it. The model of pain that you gravitate towards in your own practice is more of what we call this biopsychosocial model of pain. So can you explain for everyone exactly what that is to you and how it's different from the way people might traditionally think about approaching pain?
Yes. The biopsychosocial model is a relatively recent event because most of medicine during the 20th century was based very much on a Descartes model of kind of a very linear approach to disease. In other words, we image things and we expect if we see something amiss there, that is the problem, and we cut it out, burn it out, or inject it, or whatever might be. Mm-hmm. So that's a very old model of looking at pain. Mm-hmm. And that was really the model of disease that many physicians carry to this day, especially when we look at musculoskeletal pain. A biopsychosocial model is really a model that incorporates the biology, the bio of the human, the psychology of that individual, and then the social framework and constructs in which we or that individual is at. You know, we can have the same biology or very nearly the same biology and suffer a similar injury, but depending on our psychological framework at the time and our social framework, our capacity to be able to resist that trauma. In other words, if we're not, you know, if we're just getting by day to day and just, you know, one more event just tips us over, over what our body and mind are capable of, then we may go on to a persistent condition. So the biopsychosocial model really encompasses what it truly means to be human. And more importantly, when we come with some complaint, ache, pain, that we really need to take all those factors into consideration, not just the biology that at that moment in time.
So you would think from the name of the industry, physical therapy, that the emphasis is just on this bio side rather than all of these other psychosocial factors you just mentioned. Is this how physical therapy has always been practiced, or is this more of a recent development?
Yeah, good, great question. I think on one level, physical therapists have always had an affinity to a biopsychosocial model. We just didn't have a name for it. What I mean by that, we've always looked at the capacity of the human body and spirit to persevere. So if you think about the history of the profession in this country, it was really out of Reconstruction AIDS post-World War I. And, you know, whether you lost limbs or had head trauma or whatever, it was really about restoring and recovering and seeing the capacity to get people back to a better state. So there was always this, I guess, a mindset of belief in the power of the patient you're with to heal themselves. Now, what happened, I think and physical therapy, just like the rest of medicine in America, lost their way. We really kind of went down a bio pathway as well and really adopted a lot of the myths of imaging, diagnostic imaging, and the labels, the pathology labels, and saying, well, if you have this label, therefore you need this rehab program. And kind of we went down that reductionist mind as well, especially during the 90s and the like. But there really was a renaissance. What was coming out was the fact that, you know, we really are doing a really poor job, and we're not doing a very good job of helping people with a large number of musculoskeletal disorders. And compared to other countries, we use just orders of magnitude more diagnostic imaging, more drugs, more surgery, more injections. And of course, the opioid crisis, which really started in the 90s. And now, of course, it's, you know, two decades later, you know, we're reading about it daily. But, you know, that was in the making for two decades. And I think, you know, physical therapists have finally realized that, you know, the biggest strengths we had was spending time with patients and believing in them. And we kind of devalued that skill set because there wasn't as much research around it. And it seemed like it was not hard science or, you know, evidence based, if you will. But, you know, it's like many things, it's where you look. And, you know, there's a whole volume, a large volume of evidence on this idea of what we call cognitive behavioral type approaches, where we're really looking at more holistically at the person in managing their complaints.
And what you call this spending more time with patients and this cognitive sort of approach, there are all of these new acronyms and all of this new research popping up around this idea. There's therapeutic neuroscience education and pain neuroscience education. What role does that kind of stuff play in your practice right now?
I would say it is 100% of my practice. And what I mean by that is because I see primarily persistent and chronic pain disorders, but I see a lot of acute disorders. And I always, a comment I make frequently is never underestimate the power of the medical system to make you worse. And people kind of say, what? and then I go on to say, you know, when it comes to pain conditions, we're too aggressive. We need to first understand why you hurt. Whether you sprained your ankle or have a chronic neck pain, it's the same neurology. So why you hurt and what the brain is telling you about your discomfort. You know, depending on the condition, everybody gets a level of education about what pain is, because we know that the current understanding of pain is really distorted in our society. And it goes back literally hundreds of years to a model that's no longer valid, but really it's still being taught in a lot of medical schools and healthcare schools across the country. So to answer your question a little more deeply is that it really is embodied my personal practice and the practices that our business are involved in.
Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between the kind of neuroscience education that you give to someone who comes in with acute pain, maybe an injury that they need some rehab on, versus someone who comes in with a chronic condition and has tried everything to solve it and nothing's worked for them?
Yeah, good question. I probably would say that first is that idea of a more motivational interviewing and trying to get at what patient or client is after and what will make their life better. And, you know, that I guess just transforms whether it's an acute injury or more persistent problem. And so starting at that, kind of at that point, and then really, you know, that question, I think, of just asking, what do you think is wrong? And just, it's always amazing when you ask an open-ended question like that, what you'll get. And from that, if I hear a recitation of what the MRI said and, you know, all these, you know, terms, pathology terms, it frames me to, okay, this, the belief system of the patient is, you know, puts a lot of power in what this is and what those images might say. Mm. And that generally will lead me at least to try to get open the conversation about the fact that most people have changes on imaging in the musculoskeletal system, especially as we age. You know, we get wrinkles on the inside, which is normal age-related changes, but we often give them, you know, nasty words like degeneration and torn and herniated and all these things. So a lot of it is trying to, you know, just get folks aware of, don't put too much stake in the imaging. Use it for what it's designed to do, rule out serious pathology that may be cancer, disease processes that may be life-threatening in nature. That the imaging is really good at that. It's not good at determining treatment decisions for the vast majority of musculoskeletal conditions. Mm-hmm. So that's where a lot of that education might happen. You know, and it's someone with an acute injury and someone with a chronic injury, though often there they've had multiple scans, multiple different providers, and simple saying, well, are you pleased with where you're at to date? And inevitably people are not. And that gives you a window to say, well, let's maybe try something different. Are you game to try a much more a bigger approach, a more holistic approach to getting on top of this.
Mm-hmm. So once they say, yes, I'm game to try this bigger, more holistic approach, what are the next steps for them? What kind of homework do you give them? How often do they come back and see you? What does the whole process look like?
Yeah, so a lot of times the homework I give is, to start with, is just some basics of understanding what pain is and the neuroscience of pain. So that might be watching a couple short YouTube videos. It might be some podcasts that we've done to say, hey, this is your homework to listen to it, to these things or to watch these things and come back with some questions. In the meantime, you know, let's address the other factors again, you know, determining if sleep cycle disruption is a problem. You know, is there anxiety and or depression? Are you aware of just basic breathing patterns? So I often give almost all patients at least one breathing exercise to start, you know, on the first day. So whether it be a deep four in, holding for seven, and exhaling for eight, 4-7-8 type breath, something of that nature. And it's amazing just inability of people to just breathe, you know, which of course brings in that the beginning of the understanding of just, you know, the body's in a fight or flight response all the time. So but we have to dial the nervous system down. So let's attack it that way. So I really talk in those terms of, you know, a top-down idea. Let's get the nervous system to quiet down. And then from the bottom up, whatever area of the body's problematic, let's work it on, we know the power, the biggest drug in the world is called exercise. The challenge is titrating it the right amount for you at this point in time. So let's figure out how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would you say is the percentage of patients who latch on to this and say, yeah, that sounds like a great plan, I'm game to do it, versus the percentage who are just really skeptical, maybe even offended, and walk right out of your office?
Mm-hmm. That's actually a great question. I think my batting average is improving. It used to be
doing some A/B testing to get to the the perfect pitch.
Yeah, because it really was not good in the beginning. The challenge is, it's often heard as, you know, it's all in my head, and you know, the fact is, our entire life experience is in our head, but in our society, you know, that's heard as psychology, which is it's still culturally not very acceptable if you have, quote, you know, psychological problems or issues, right? You know, or we label those things not in a good way. So I really try to say, you know, this concept of neurology, that, you know, all of our experiences is how is our brain is interpreting signals coming in, and then we often have outputs that may be helpful or not helpful. So really delicate, and I think to start, but it often, I don't go there on a first session unless, you know, there's clearly trust with the patient, and it's an assumption and I could be wrong, but I'm sensing, hey, we got a therapeutic alliance here. There's a good comfort zone here. I can broach that type of topic. But for all folks, I think the simple part of just a nervous system that's heightened, that it's on high alert, and these signals are going off constantly. So how can we calm down the nervous system? That usually is accepted 9 out of 10 times with most folks, because that's not very threatening, right? It's, you know, yes, it makes sense that, you know, I'm having pain. My nerves must be somehow involved in this experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I imagine that there's a lot of overlap between the patients who kind of reject this and the patients who are very fixated on these structural abnormalities that are showing up in their MRIs. How do you approach talking to those patients specifically?
Yeah. Well, first, you know, I've learned, I guess, as you get older, that changing beliefs and to try to change the belief system is extremely hard. I don't try to change someone's beliefs anymore. I try to find little windows into getting them to do more healthy things. A good example might be a patient with persistent back pain I've seen, now over on and off over a 2-year period, but came in very disabled, a high functioning individual that, you know, came in and, you know, had developed some numbness in his groin region that just took a bad turn. Basically, this is a biker, and for anybody who lives in Colorado and bikes a lot, they'll know that symptom if you bike too much. Well, unfortunately, he had back pain at the time, and they imaged him, and he had an old spondylolisthesis, just a mild grade 1, and somehow down the pathway, they thought this individual was having, you know, some type of cauda equina syndrome, which is, you know, the nerve roots that are in the bottom of your spine, which, you know, can be a severe problem if because of the nerves that go to your perineal region, obviously. So bowel and bladder problems can happen. Well, this had nothing to do. He had numbness from sitting on a bike seat too much, but nonetheless, when they image him, they see this pathology, and that's what's labeled. Well, for those that know spondylolisthesis, he had had no trauma. He recalled trauma back in high school playing football, and he described it. I'm like, oh, that was probably clearly when you got your spondy. But he felt that explained his condition currently. And, you know, just like you break an arm, the bones heal. People have spondylosis fractures and they heal. And, you know, you're left with that for your life. Things look a little bit odd, mm-hmm. but you're left with that. So fast forward. So I tried to, you know, scientifically describe that and describe that, how, you know, things heal, et cetera. And also that why his numbness, you know, kind of goes along with his biking and et cetera. But he believed that if he bent forward, literally that would slip, that he was just avoiding bending because he felt that that vertebrae would just slip off. It would just kind of come off the top. And the fear of movement was extremely high. And the good news is, like, over time, he's doing very, very well. However, he still, at the end of all this, he still says, well, whenever we add a new activity, he'll say, well, you know, what will that do to my spondy? You know, what will that do to that spondylolisthesis? And he'll see me smile and he goes, yeah, I know what your answer is going to be. You know, but tell me anyway. I said, okay, it's not going to do anything. Okay, thank you.
Still nothing.
You know, so because it's so embedded, you know, that image just seared on his mm-hmm. mind that, you know, literally his spine was unstable and it was going to be slipping. And those types of patients have shown me that, you know, you can still improve even if your belief system doesn't change totally. And by doing the techniques, again, just breathing, graded exposure, getting him to do more and more, getting him back on the bike, you know, teaching him with the mirrors and things to show him that, hey, you can move in this manner. And so there's lots of things that you do as part of the treatment, and it probably didn't change his belief system. I could give another example, 180 degrees the opposite, where I had a patient last week, 21-year-old, after an ACL reconstruction that on first glance had gone well about 15 months ago. And then, you know, 6 months ago, she started developing severe knee pain and just was, you know, having a lot of difficulty. Of course, go back to the surgeons that, you know, maybe we need to go in there and do more surgery. And, you know, this is someone that had extreme on examination, hypersensitivity to her knee, a lack of what we call lateralization, didn't really know right from left when you showed pictures of knees. So basically her brain had shifted, didn't really know where that, didn't really own that knee. She was in bioengineering, explained what was going on and that this is, you know, what's happening, talked about phantom limb pain, which she was aware of. And I had her listen to some things, comes back the next week, is like asking me these deep level questions on the neurology of how that occurred. And she's like totally shifted her understanding to neuroscience and is like, was feeling better already just through knowledge, but had totally changed her previous belief and of what was going on with her knee. So, I mean, those are like two sides of the spectrum in folks, you know. My background has shown me the people that buy in and get it, they do better. They mm-hmm. do better quicker because it's not foreign, and they're more willing to push into activities, knowing that even if I do flare up, I know what that is. I know what the nervous system did. I can, and I have some tools that I can dial that back down, so I can continue to quote rehab, and I'm not as fearful of overdoing it.
Right, and it's so interesting because I guess either way, you're doing the same thing. You are either slowly or quickly convincing your brain that there's really nothing to be afraid of and that your body's safe and that these kind of overreaction signals don't need to be taking place when your body's not actually in physical danger. And in one case, you have someone who's just logically thinking that because they believe it due to the education they've absorbed. And then on the other hand, you have this guy who's super, super skeptical and just is slowly being proven wrong by the fact that his body can actually handle it.
Yeah, it is. It is a fascinating thing. And that's why at the end of the day, I think, you know, the key to great clinicians is if we stay curious and non-judgmental. We will not burn out and we'll be of some use to people, because that's really, I look at these and I'm so curious of how, you know, how different brains will accept or shift when given, you know, information and data and experiences, you know, mm-hmm. and they're just different trajectories.
Yeah, I think that's such a great way to stay satisfied in any job. Just always keep learning, keep your own brain stimulated and stay curious about what's happening with other people. That's great. So in the spectrum of physical therapists who are out there right now, you are obviously very, very heavy on this approach. I imagine there are plenty of others who are partaking in this same approach as well. Why aren't all PTs doing this yet?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think it's like much of knowledge translation. If you're not exposed to it in entry level, the education or your first professional level education, and you're exposed to models that are old models, you know, that's how you go into treatment, right? You kind of basically, you're doing to people. In other words, you know, I'm going to do this to have an effect on this, you know, this joint, if you will. So part of it is, you know, just the training initially has created a bias. But I would say what's interesting is anytime that I've been around therapists that are work with folks that have chronic pain, and that's so common now, there's so high prevalence of persistent pain, they have failed and they get frustrated, and then they learn about, well, no wonder I'm frustrated because I was approaching it the wrong way. Mm-hmm. People, what I find, it's actually almost this sense of relief, like, oh my gosh, and now I have some tools. I wish I could go back there and see that person again, because I, you know, I realize why they were hypersensitive, why they would, you know, avoid certain things, and that actually some of the things were doing to them were harmful from the brain's perspective. It was a threat, and we were actually dialing their nervous system up in an attempt to, you know, help, but we were no different than any other intervention. It was not intervening on the right part of the system. So I think the therapists that when they're exposed to it, they jump on it. I think it's just a matter of not enough exposure. Now, having said that, most of our conferences, even conferences in like manual therapy and more hands-on therapy courses, there's a big dosing of modern pain sciences now. So that in the conferences, you'll see a large number of courses and breakout sessions on these topics.
Yeah. What would you recommend to someone who is a physical therapist and wants to be more involved in this and wants to start implementing this more in their own practice?
Yeah, I would, International Spine and Pain Institute is a group, ISPinstitute.com. And they, Dr. Adrian Lowe, who is involved there, has created a lot of content that's accessible, meaning you can do, there's some online content. And really, there's content geared towards your front desk receptionist type people, some short little courses, you know, a couple hours they can take, where really you realize that from the moment someone walks into a clinic, how you talk to them when they're in discomfort frames the rest of that experience in the clinic and frankly the rest of their day. And realizing it's not just you as the clinician, it's environments that we need to create and that are healthy for folks that are entering the system, and creating colleagues across disciplines that have the same philosophy and understanding around pain. And so that's really where I think just even a basic understanding of just some key things to educate folks, that's a good place to start. And, you know, obviously, you know, things like the Curable app, we're now able to say, okay, I'm not, may not have the time, resources to do that, but we now have places that we can educate people and provide resources that, you know, that do a lot of this stuff and complement the work that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In your whole career, what has been the most incredible or meaningful recovery that you've witnessed?
You know, it's some of the ones that are probably most memorable to me are really the notes that come back and say, you know, I didn't share this, but I was suicidal when I saw you. And wow. It crossed my mind, and I did not think I was going to act, but, you know, I'm fortunate that we entered our life at the same time or met at the same time. And those are pretty profound when you get those after the fact. You've worked with someone with, you know, longstanding persistent pain, and you realize, you know, where that struggle was at, and that fortunately, you know, able to be of some use and help people on that way. So there's been a couple of those that really stick in my mind. And, you know, the other ones are really I love working with older adults, and, you know, I have an individual, she's 96, she just turned, and, you know, just active. And she's really one of those where, you know, was struggling a lot and realized that it was really the power of just, you know, a lot of hands-on care, but also just, you know, reframing, you know, where she was at in the condition and how to, you know, allow her body to understand and to heal more, again, as an advancing age, and yet, you know, was a robust 96-year-old, and, you know, and was, and I think that often we there's a big bias against our older adults, and that we undertreat them. We're basically poisoning them with, you know, as we now know, 6 to 7 medications they'll be on, which, you know, it's just, you know, nobody knows the interactions more than 2 to 3 at once. And just, it's just this chemical milieu, and they're the fog that they're under often due to, that's really side effects of a lot of these medications. And so there's been a number that worked with it, you know, felt okay, been part of, you know, changing that mindset around these pharmaceuticals and getting people off of these drugs that, frankly, you know, when you ask, you know, is this helping you? Is your life better? You know, the answer is invariably not. And so I think those are the ones that I personally really enjoy. And I think that's our next big movement, you know, because we look at our aging population and the amount of pain in that population. We really, it's a burgeoning problem that we have to treat it differently than our current models are doing.
Yeah, gosh, 96 years old. Isn't that amazing that our bodies and our brains are just still learning how to interact with each other at that age?
Exactly. And that's why I say I love that book, you know, by Doig, you know, The Brain That Changes Itself, and mm-hmm. just the whole concept of neuroplasticity and the constant ability for us to, you know, to adapt, you know, even in later life.
Gosh, I love that. Is there anything else that's on your mind that you feel compelled to share with chronic pain sufferers, other physical therapists, people in other healthcare professions across the world?
Yes. Well, I mean, my current passion, obviously, is, well, probably for the last 15 years, has really been this opioid crisis and epidemic, and just this understanding that, you know, those drugs actually make pain worse. They make the body more sensitive, and it alters our pain processing in a very negative way, and that that is the problem with these drugs used in a chronic nature, not used for what they were initially used for during a very short duration within a surgical environment. So they were never meant to be used for persistent problems. So the key, though, if now is how do we reverse that process? Because once addiction happens, then the ability to taper is a very long process. That and often people are going through withdrawal symptoms and not even aware of it because the tapers are happening too quickly, and then rebounding back at with similar or higher doses. So I think that if I could share anything is that reach out to a knowledgeable physician that truly understands tapering, because most people taper too quickly and physicians don't know how to taper people. Many don't. And so that's a challenge. So I always say, when we're in pain, let's not let the treatments kill us. Let's get to the root of the problem. The problem is real. All pain is real. But let's not kill ourselves in an attempt to try to get rid of it.
How do you juggle this idea of tapering someone off of their medication with incorporating this neuroscience education into the mix and encouraging them to start exercising again? Are those two in conflict, or can that help someone to taper off more quickly?
It's a delicate dance with not many people that are collaborating together. Again, we have all this addiction and very little support system. I often say the pharmaceutical industry, created and promoted and sustained this epidemic. And until some of these lawsuits go through, and much like tobacco, we start having money coming back in to better treatment, it's going to be a slog. We're seeing a number of counties in Colorado, for instance, that are suing several of the pharmaceutical companies makers because, again, they just flooded these little communities with all these opioids and just reckless. And the number of deaths and addictions in these communities is stunning. So I there's not enough resources. Having said that, we do know that if the power of exercise, the power of mindfulness, the power of breathing can dial down the threats of persistent pain. So if we can at least start there with no, at the same level of medication and get a program started, 3 to 4 weeks establishing a baseline, understanding what needs to be done before a taper would start. So ideally, getting on a program prior to, and then that way there's activities, there's strategies in place, and so that's less fearful as you begin that tapering, because that's clearly one of the big fear. It's a big fear as people come off of these. So that's generally the approach we would take. And that's that. So starting up, getting someone on a good program prior to the beginning of the tapering.
I know that when you're working with patients, you recommend certain resources for pain neuroscience. You give some of them the Curable app to help them along. Do you also ever partner with any psychologists that you refer people to if they have particularly tricky triggers for their physical pain that are related to like PTSD or anything like that?
Absolutely. Because we see that the relationships, again, PTSD, a great example is whiplash-associated disorders. It's been shown that the impact of event really sears on a person's brain. Those that have, if they've been, say, rear-ended in a car accident, they didn't see it coming, and they have some fear around that intersection or just even in a car, those people are much, much more likely to go on to persistent pain because of, again, it's that the brain is hyperactive and it's the threat is always there. I often say they're always looking over their shoulder, waiting for the next hit. And the other thing is, more in women than men, the sexual abuse happens in men as well. But clearly the data is very strong that a lot of women that are in persistent pain have had some type of sexual trauma in their past. Mm-hmm. And so those, you know, being alert to that and providing, you know, really good resources for those folks that they can work with someone skilled in that type of work.
So how do you bring that up when someone's like, I just came in because my knee was hurting. Why are you asking me about if I have a history of sexual abuse in my past?
Yeah, and that's one of those where, again, I think timing is important. And, you know, that's not a question brought up on a first session. There's times it is. There's times that an open-ended question kind of leads to that when I say, did anything else happen around that time that you can recall? And that opens the door, patients with some folks, but usually it's a little bit, you know, there's again that therapeutic alliance and this trust factor that can help make those conversations much, much easier. And again, I always broach it, respectfully, gingerly, and with the understanding of saying, you know, the reason I bring that up is because it's just more prevalent. So that's why we ask those questions.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I think we just have a couple minutes left. Any final thoughts to share?
Well, first of all, I'm honored to be on this and to talk about this. We can make a difference. There's a movement I feel that is happening, that we're getting back to the essence of what it means to be human, and that our innate power is there, but the ability to reach out to like-minded folks that are walking with you to get you through these tough times. You know, there's people out there that can help do that. And then I can't emphasize enough that there's so many more tools available now to help folks that are in persistent pain, and that the tools of the past, the drugs, the surgeries, the injections, et cetera, they may have helped some, but as a nation, it's not the right direction. We clearly have to go a different way. And one of the ways I like to think about it is flipping the paradigm, that we start when we have persistent pain with things that have high levels of evidence, such as, you know, mindfulness, breathing, physical activity, therapeutic neuroscience education, those types of things first. Those are your first line treatments.
Absolutely.
And then we gradually scale up anything that's more aggressive and more risky. No, don't start with the risky things first.
Absolutely. Very well said. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Tim. We really appreciate it.
And thank you.
Of course.
Thanks for listening to Like Mind, Like Body. If you want to start learning some pain neuroscience to jumpstart your own recovery, then you should definitely check out Curable, the app that brought you this podcast. You can get started for free at curablehealth.com. In fact, pretty much all of the neuroscience education on Curable is free. And if you are a physical therapist looking for options to give your patients to supplement what you're doing with them, then you should check out Curable too, as well as the Pain Reframed podcast, which Tim is the co-host of. Okay, that's it. See you later. Bye.